from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. This week, an NBA ban, Ukrainian troops push back in the east, a botched execution in Oklahoma, and rough weather in the south and east. On Tuesday, after taped racist comments hit the media, NBA Commissioner Adam Silver brought the hammer down on LA Clippers owner Donald Sterling.
Effective immediately, I am banning Mr. Sterling for life from any association with the Clippers organization or the NBA.
In Oklahoma, a botched execution and new debate over the death penalty, witness Courtney Francisco described the last long minutes of the condemned Clayton Lockett.
He was struggling to talk, but those were the words we got out. Man, I'm not, and something's wrong.
And 39 died in tornado and downpour this week. A tornado roared over this woman's house in Mayflower, Arkansas.
I just heard this horrible rumble all around you, and the whole cellar filled up with dust. I've never seen anything like this.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Kristen Welker of NBC News, Yoki Driesen of Foreign Policy Magazine, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What do you see on Donald Sterling, Ukraine, the economy, ours and China's? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington, Kristen Welker, White House correspondent for NBC News. Kristen, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks so much for having me back.
Great to have you. From Washington as well, Yoki Driesen, deputy editor for news at Foreign Policy, author of The Invisible Front, Love and Loss in an Era of Endless War, out this fall. Yoki, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you very much, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Kristen, and Yoki.
Can we go first to that eastern section of Ukraine? This is in your wheelhouse, Yoki, and yours as well, Kristen, where today we have seen the Ukrainian military pushing back against, well, we've all seen what's been going on there, and two helicopters reportedly brought down. Yoki, is this the beginning of a military confrontation? Is this Kiev trying to say, we are not conceding the east? Reportedly, tens of thousands of Russian troops still outside Ukraine, just over the border. What do you see unfolding here, Yoki?
I think this is the moment. You know, for weeks and weeks and weeks, there's been a buildup. There's been this question of who moves first? Does anyone move? What's the chess game? And this is now the moment where we get the answer to that question, for good or for bad. You have, as you mentioned, Ukrainian special forces moving into a city called Slovyansk with helicopters as well. The pro-Russian militias in the city shot down two of the helicopters, which again makes you realize that these aren't just random villagers who picked up guns. These are very well-trained, very well-armed, very well-organized fighters, undoubtedly many of whom are Russian. But now you have open clashes in a fairly major city. You have Putin saying openly again that he will not let this happen, that he won't let what he calls criminal acts from the fascist government in Kiev. So again, not very subtle language from Putin, but that he will not let this continue. So you have what had been building for days. A couple days ago, the president of Ukraine said that he had lost the east, that the security forces he had were not up to the job. Now he's making what appears to be a last-ditch fight to take back at least this one city. It's not going well, and Russia is openly saying, we will not let this continue. So something has to give. Either he pulls back from this, having lost, he continues, perhaps beating the militia and taking the city, and then Russia has what it might need as the pretense to move across the border.
And this is the city in which you've got that half-dozen-plus European observers, four Germans and more, I think it's the same city where this is going on, Yoki.
That's right. And these are unarmed observers who were captured, paraded out in front of cameras. They're being described as spies. Some of them are German. There was an interesting moment this past week where Gerhard Schroeder, the former German chancellor, was photographed hugging Putin at this sort of lavish and very garish birthday party. And as you can imagine, the German press went ballistic. Their point was, we have German soldiers being held captive by Russian thugs. Meanwhile, the pro-Russian chancellor is hugging Putin, smiling with him, posing for photos. So there's a very weird disconnect that centers around this very potentially tragic story of these missing soldiers.
Kristen Welker, at the White House, we have the German leader Angela Merkel in town in Washington this week with the president. Are they talking Ukraine plans, Russia?
They absolutely are. And I can tell you that the chancellor just arrived here at the White House a few moments ago, Tom. Ukraine is going to be the big topic of discussion in the Oval Office today. And President Obama wants to essentially enforce stiffer sanctions. So far, there have been several rounds of sanctions. They have mostly focused on targeting individuals. The EU has been hesitant to move forward with broader sanctions because, of course, their economies are inextricably linked with Russia's economies. So today, I think that President Obama is going to be trying to do some arm twisting because Germany is really key to this equation and key to getting those broader sectoral sanctions against the mining industries, the banking industries that the EU has been so reluctant to move forward with. But the question is, what, barring that, can the U.S. do? They have ruled out military action. And if you look at our latest NBC News Wall Street Journal poll, 47% of Americans say the U.S. should be less involved in world affairs. So the question is, what can the U.S. do? Today, the president going to try to make the case for stronger sanctions.
Of course, Tom? The U.S. does something like $20 billion of business with Russia. The Europeans do $300-plus
exactly.
billion. So they get a lot more skin in the game there. All the way back on Tuesday, and things are moving at this point. But this was John Kerry at the Atlantic Council in Washington, talking about the U.S. relationship with Russia.
The events in Ukraine are a wake-up call. Our European allies have spent more than 20 years with us working to integrate Russia into the Euro-Atlantic community. But what Russia's actions in Ukraine tell us is that today Putin's Russia is playing by a different set of rules.
Jack, are the United States and Europe going to let Eastern Ukraine go?
Well, I think that's Mr. Putin's expectation, and I think he believes that self-interest will dictate that the European, the ties to the Russian economy, natural resources that we've just heard about, will prevail over sort of the abstract line of world order. However, you know, our Americans are putting pressure on the Allies to sacrifice more than we would. But whether they will or not, we don't know. Today, Secretary Hagel is making a speech in which he's going to say, you know, this is a wake-up call for Europe, and Europe must deter Russian aggression. The way to do that is to spend more on defense. You've been on a kind of holiday from history. Wake up. Here's history across the border. Whether that will make any difference, we don't know. And whether, you know, the sending 150 American troops, I think it is, to each of the Baltic states and perhaps Poland, whether that's going to make any difference seems very unlikely. And then we have today's report in the New York Times that the sanctions that the president has been citing, you know, he's been citing, well, the ruble is down and the stock market. No. Apparently, the evidence is very equivocal. And the headline says, sanctions effect appear mostly psychological so far.
We've got more to look at on that front. Things in motion in Ukraine as we speak today. We get whiplash on this show sometimes abroad and back home. Let's bring it way back home to that NBA story. Donald Sterling, owner of, still as of today, of the LA Clippers, in a private conversation with remarks universally interpreted as quite racist. And boy, the hammer came down. He's banned from the NBA. Here again, the NBA commissioner, Adam Silver.
The views expressed by Mr. Sterling are deeply offensive and harmful. That they came from an NBA owner only heightens the damage and my personal outrage. Sentiments of this kind are contrary to the principles of inclusion and respect that form the foundation of our diverse, multicultural, and multi-ethnic league.
To say the least, 70-80% of NBA players African-American, and here was this owner bad-mouthing, in very racist terms, that crowd. NBA great Kareem Abdul-Jabbar talked with CNN about the whole affair.
These things have to be eliminated. This our nation is about equal opportunity and fairness. It should be. And what Mr. Sterling was all about was discrimination. It's a very ugly face to turn to the world, and I'm glad he's no longer in a position to be seen as the face of the NBA.
Kristen Welker, what do you make of all this at Dazen? What have we seen in this great drama played out so quickly in the NBA?
Well, first of all, I think it's interesting the sort of consensus and the swiftness with which we saw leaders from all sectors come forward and denounce these comments. President Obama talked about it in Asia before the NBA had actually weighed in with some incredibly forceful language. So I think this is a moment of reflection, not only for the NBA, but in general, just to do some soul searching about what people in powerful positions are allowed to get away with, whether it be racial comments or any other type of unethical behavior. And I think in addition to that, Tom, it's not just a moment for the NBA to do some soul searching, but also for the NAACP. They were going to give Donald Sterling an award and sort of overlook a history of not only making racially offensive comments, but behavior that was perceived as being racist. So I think that you'll see that organization look inside and say, what do we need to do differently to prevent ourselves from being in a position like this again, where we're about to hand an award over to someone who has been openly and outwardly racist.
There was the irony of his philanthropic donations to the NAACP and others kind of buying him that award. Meanwhile, he's a billionaire plus. Jack Beatty, has a new line been drawn here in our society?
I think that there is a norm now, and the word is banned. You're banned in America if you are publicly racist. And that is, there's something heartening about that. We all remember when that was simply, you know, racist expression was the coin of the day.
But this was private, Jack, or at least
yes,
he thought it was.
It's true. And that fair-minded Kareem Abdul-Jabbar made that point, that that is an equivocal matter. Nevertheless, a norm is there, whether private or public, you get banned.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news this hour. Donald Sterling, banned from the NBA, deadly weather, armed forces in motion in Ukraine. China's economy may be number one by one measure this year. At home, job numbers up. We're joined by White House correspondent for NBC News, Kristen Welker, by Yoki Driesen, deputy editor for news at Foreign Policy Magazine, and our own Jack Beatty. We've got a big table of things to look at, but let's go just a little bit more on Ukraine, Russia. Pete in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Pete, you're on the air.
Yes. Hello, Tom.
Hi.
The thing I'm really struck by is it looks as though the post-Cold World War order that was established about 20 years ago is really starting to disintegrate in a whole variety of ways. And I'm sort of stunned. My background's history, social policy, and I'm just sort of stunned by the missteps made over 20 years, the kind of, you know, zero-sum attitude of some nations, American included, and that when someone like Mr. Putin would appear back 14 years ago, that was a real cause for alarm. Why were we not more attentive? I mean, were we just so driven by progress that we just weren't paying attention to what was in front of us?
Pete, let me pick up your big observation, and Yoki Driesen, if I may put it to you. I mean, our caller is not the only one who looks out around the world and says, wait a minute, this whole post-World War II, Cold War and later order, we got used to the idea of evolution and progress in global order, of certain verities. We wouldn't have chaos. We wouldn't have just anything going on. Breaking down. What about it, Yoki?
I completely agree with the caller. I think it's spot on. You know, there's the one very macro 30,000-foot issue, which was there was this hope that we were going to be in a democratic age, and that was inevitable, that you'd have former Soviet republics become democracies, Asian republics, African republics during the Arab Spring, which I think Putin actually accurately described as an Arab winter. You had this initial spate of hope of democracy across the Middle East. Instead, you've had chaos, you've had repression in Egypt and elsewhere. So I think he's entirely right about the democratic tide. And then you look at NATO. I mean, NATO for 50 years did what it was supposed to do. It kept the peace. But European countries have cut their budgets. They've sort of relied on the U.S. The U.S. has looked elsewhere. Its priorities were the Middle East. So it's also kind of shunned NATO and doesn't really care about it. Meanwhile, you have Vladimir Putin simmering in Moscow. And to him, NATO, which was an irrelevance to us, is the issue. He sees NATO being pushed further and further into Eastern Europe, coming closer and closer to Russia. We see that as sort of benign, as a sign that, hey, Poland's a stable country. Let's welcome Poland into the West. He sees it as, hey, the imperialist West is coming right to my borders. And we missed that completely.
Is Obama blowing it? Do we look like, as Kristen says, Americans say they don't want to get involved abroad. And the president clearly doesn't want war. He has said as much. You know, what do you want, war? On the other hand, things just seem to be kind of going.
I interviewed about a week after this, the first crisis sparked, a four-star general who'd spent a lot of time in Europe. And I asked him about the Obama comments. And he said that he was stunned and that he could not remember a commander-in-chief ever doing that, ever right at the outset of a crisis saying all military options are off the table. He said that had he been president, he would have said, We don't want to use military force. We're devoted to every other possible option, but not taken off the table as definitively. And it's reasonable that people all over the world, in the Middle East, in Africa, in Asia, you know, people who look at China's rise, especially allies like Japan, look to this White House and say, where is the red line? At what point will he say this far and no further, given that he has literally said this is a red line and then allowed it to continue?
Kristen, what about it? Is this wisdom, progress, take war off the table? After all, everybody says nobody wants war ever. On the other hand, is this unleashing mayhem?
Well, and the president was asked about that while he was traveling in Asia, asked to defend his foreign policy because, of course, his critics say he hasn't been strong enough, not just on Ukraine, but on Syria and other issues. And he slammed back at his critics and basically made the argument that they are not remembering how botched the Iraq war was. So that was his defense. And then he argued that and defended his sort of step-by-step process and approach toward foreign policy. But I think that the challenge for the Obama administration is, as you point out, the fact that he's drawn a line and said that military options are off the table. The other thing that some Republicans, some Democrats as well, are pushing the Obama administration to do is to send military aid to Ukraine. The administration says they have sent aid to Ukraine, but they're not sending lethal aid. And that's something to watch, I think, in the coming weeks. Will the administration change its stance on that point? Because that is something that could potentially make a difference. If you listen to what's coming out of Ukraine, the officials there say they feel helpless against some of these pro-Russian forces.
One more call on this front, if I may, Kristen, forgive me, and we'll go on to NBA and Oklahoma. Richard in Duke Center, Pennsylvania. Richard, you're on.
Hi, Tom. I spent 32 years in the Pennsylvania National Guard going through this Cold War crisis, and putting 150 soldiers in each country is not going to make a hill of beans.
You're talking in Estonia and beyond, sort of. Yeah, they're symbolic.
Right. If the Soviet doctrine believes in offense, straight offense, and if once they start their motors, we're not going to stop them. Not with 150 soldiers.
No, I mean, those are a symbol of some kind, but what's behind it when you come this way? Jack Beatty, weigh in here. The president clearly, he wants war off the table. He sees this as progress. I mean, are these the birth pangs of a new and better order? Or while we talk this way, are we sliding back into something more chaotic, Jack?
Well, it looks as if, if we had taken a stronger stand, we could have deterred Mr. Putin. But roll the clock back. I'm old enough to remember 1956. Not only did the Hungarians invade, the Soviets invade Hungary and kill 30,000 odd people, tanks in the streets of Budapest. But at that same time, simultaneously, the British and the French and the Israelis seized the Suez Canal. Yep. In other words, the United States not only wasn't deterring the Soviet Union, it wasn't controlling its allies. And I don't remember, of course, I was only 12 or so years old, but I don't remember a hue and cry about the weakness of the United States. President Eisenhower had his Secretary of State, Dulles, had in some ways encouraged the uprising in Hungary, talking about captive peoples, you know, shaking off the yoke and talking about rolling back Soviet power. But people understood that, and certainly the president reflected, that this was the Russian sphere of influence, and there was nothing we could do about it. It wasn't a vital U.S.
Yeah.
interest.
Yeah. And, of course, you don't have to roll all the way back to 56, 2008, the Russian invasion of Georgia, and you're right there. We've got so much to look at here, but that question is hanging big around the world right now. Maria in Iowa City, thank you for calling, Maria. You're on the air. What's on your mind?
Yes, hi. I was calling concerning the NBA. With the discussion should rather be not what Sterling said currently, but more of the fact of he was a racist when he purchased the Clippers. The question should be why these players even played for him in the first place, knowing that he was a racist, happily playing for him, taking his money, and where's Alvin Gentry in this conversation when he was fired, won his lawsuit against him for being racist, but yet this man has continued to own the team, continued to have players play for him, but knowing that he was a racist, but as long as it was kept private and he didn't talk about it.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. The point has been made on this air. Kevin Blackstone, the wonderful sports reporter, was with us earlier this week and made a very similar point. But Kristen Welker, there is a kind of tension here in what we're seeing. On the one hand, you have Adam Silver coming out with this electric press conference where he brings down the boom, banned from the NBA. But like 5 minutes earlier, here was Donald Sterling, owner, with all this history, and nobody was talking about it.
I think that's one of the big questions that is being asked right now. And I think that as the NBA begins to look at how this could have happened, how they got to this place, I think that they will hone in on that exact point. I can tell you that based on some of my reporting over the past week and in talking to some of the sports reporters who covered the team, there was this major disconnect because the Sterling, who they had personal relationships with, didn't seem to be racist. He treated people, again, this is based on my reporting, he treated people with respect, people of color. And so there was this sense that if he had made these racial comments or if he had this racist past, that that was in the past, that somehow he had reformed and that it wasn't a part of who he is today. And so I think that that's part of why you saw that disconnect. But again, I think that when the NBA does its investigation into how they got to this point, that is going to be the big issue that they focus on.
I have to say there was something very bracing in a good way in the clarity of that action by the NBA. We'll see what happens with the team. That could get complicated. Who buys it, who doesn't, whether Donald Sterling tries to hang on to it. He still hasn't been clear about that. We've got a lot to look at here, and I want to move to Oklahoma, the botched execution there this week of convicted murderer, horrible murder case, Clayton Lockett. The whole thing sparked controversy and a call for a statewide review of Oklahoma's lethal injections, maybe even the death penalty. Speaking with NPR, David Autry, the lawyer for Lockett, the man who died horribly, ultimately, of a heart attack and not the botched injection, said things cannot occur in a country with the Eighth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, this kind of thing, which is supposed to prohibit cruel and unusual punishment.
It was a horrible, horrible crime, yet we don't treat the murderers like they treat their murder victims in this country, if we're going to call ourselves civilized. And we certainly don't have the kind of spectacle that occurred last night in any system that is abiding by the Eighth Amendment.
The injections went in and things did not work. He's writhing there, tied down on the table, ultimately died of a heart attack. It was horrible. Let's go right to our listeners. Iowa City again. Lynn. Hi, Lynn. You're on the air. What do you think?
Hi. I have been absolutely disgusted, and it's just the reporting of it over and over and over has wrecked, and my gut has just turned over. I'm like, okay, we understand. It was botched. Please quit telling us about it. He got what he deserved, but not only like the botched execution, but I'm tired of hearing about it.
So it's not the death penalty or the messed up injection. It's just hearing about it that bugs you, Lynn.
Well, yes. I mean, we understood it was going to happen.
Yeah.
That he was going to have the death penalty, and I'm not against that. But I am against the fact that it did not go well, and that's cruel, and that we just keep hearing about it, and I've got my news on all the time, and my 4-year-old is hearing this, and I'm thinking, oh.
Lynn's ready to put it in the rearview mirror, and yet, I don't know who to come to on this. Kristen, I'll come to you. You may not have expertise in execution, but it does seem strange. I mean, Americans all over the country commit suicide in significant numbers every day without any help. They kill themselves.
Right.
It doesn't seem as that complicated to die. The body is tough and doesn't want to die, but it is confusing why these difficulties. Leave aside the death penalty itself for a moment. Just if you're going to have it, why are we seeing these repeated instances of failure to do it effectively, quickly?
I think that's the big question. White House Press Secretary Jay Carney this week expressed the fact that the White House was deeply concerned about this botched execution. And so I think that it's going to reopen the conversation about how these executions are carried out and whether or not they're actually ethical. At this point, the Justice Department isn't launching a new review, but that is something that we could see happen potentially in the future. You know, President Obama was opposed to the death penalty back in 1996, but then as a senator said, he supported it only under extreme circumstances for heinous crimes. And so I think the question is, will we see the president actually start to recalibrate and rethink where he stands on this issue? I have to agree with your caller, though, Tom. I'm a reporter. I've covered executions. I've never been in one, but of course have covered them. It is hard to hear about the details of this case, and yet I think it's so important that we do, because it is sparking this really important conversation about how they're carried out and whether they're actually ethical.
Of course, the details of the murder were pretty grim as well, and those also in our ears this week of the victim of the murder in the first place. But we do have an Eighth Amendment against cruel and unusual punishment. That looked pretty bad. Janet in Lexington, Virginia. Janet, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you. I had back surgery, and when they moved me from the bed to the gurney, I was in agony. They gave me something that knocked me out completely. I've had a horse put down, and it took about 20 seconds to put that horse down. Now, why they can't come up with a medication is beyond me.
Yeah.
Totally beyond me.
It is confusing. Surely there will be a lot of emphasis on this now. There's been a lot of mystery around it. Who made the drug? And all the rest was kept under wraps. Oklahoma is struggling with that. All that right now. Lots of talk in recent months about raising the minimum wage. And this week that appeared to go down to a Senate filibuster, GOP-led in Washington. Nobody was happy about it. White House critical of it. Democrats critical of it. Here's Texas Republican Senator and Senate Minority Whip John Cornyn critical about the whole thing, saying the minimum wage was bad for the economy and that it was all about the Democrats trying to make Republicans look bad.
This is about trying to make this side of the aisle look bad and hard-hearted. And to try to rescue this midterm election coming up in November because they see the president's approval rating going down.
Jack, what do you see in the collapse of the higher minimum wage movement, at least for now, on Capitol Hill?
Well, I think Senator Cornyn is right and perhaps righter than he knows. He's right that the Democrats wanted the issue. It was clear it wasn't going to happen, and they're probably going to return to it. It's similar to the Equal Pay for Women Act that they tried to get through. The Republicans filibustered that, gives the Democrats another issue. Polls show that by 2-1, the public wants a raise, an increase in the minimum wage. Republicans say, wait a minute now, if the Democrats were willing to negotiate rather than 10-10, what about 9-50? And that they wouldn't even talk about that. So that's a fair point. But Cornyn may also be right when he said, you know, in a way, when he says, you know, they want to make us look hard-hearted. Well, it does make them look hard-hearted. And that's why they're unhappy about it. You know, Tim Pawlenty, the former GOP presidential candidate and a blue-collar guy from Minnesota, he commented this week, he said, you know, Republicans used to be for increases in the minimum wage because it's part of, you know, it rewards work. And we're the party of work. And if we want to make appeal to blue-collar workers, people who are really up against it, we've got to, you know, keep that wage at least up to inflation and not let these things happen. And he said, you know, we're missing the boat on an issue like this.
Kristen, we've just got a couple of seconds before the break here. Does the White House see a win even in that defeat, or is this a hobby horse they keep riding?
I think so. I think this is about rallying the base to a large extent, Tom, because the big concern on the part of Democrats is that their base doesn't turn out in midterm elections. Our NBC News Wall Street Journal poll showed that of the voters who said they voted in 2012 but not in 2010. 51% are Democrats. And remember, this issue of fairness and equality was one that helped President Obama win re-election in 2012.
Yeah,
so I think
yeah.
The Democrats are hoping that this issue will help them to hold on to the Senate.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, on Sunday, Popes John Paul II and John the 23rd were canonized by Pope Francis in Rome. Huge turnout at the Vatican for that. Very unusual. In the living memories of many of those in attendance, New York Republican Congressman Michael Grimm charged with fraud. Back in January, he threatened a reporter in the Capitol Rotunda, saying, "I'll throw you off the balcony and I'll break you in half."
Let me be clear to you. You have to do that to me again.
You're not me.
And Oscar-nominated British actor Bob Hoskins died this week at 71. Here he is as private detective Eddie Valiant in 1988's Who Framed Roger Rabbit, opposite the voice of Kathleen Turner.
Weren't you the one I caught playing patty cake with old man Acme?
You didn't catch me, Mr. Valiant. You were set up to take those pictures.
What are you talking about?
And there we are. We're looking at a week in the news. Donald Sterling banned from the NBA, deadly weather in the South and East, armed forces in motion in Ukraine. China's economy may be number one by one measure this year. And job numbers up in the U.S. 288,000 jobs created, 6.3% unemployment. That is down significantly in today's report. NBC White House correspondent Kristen Welker is with us. Yoki Driesen is here, deputy editor for news at Foreign Policy Magazine. Jack Beatty's here. You can join us as well. Boy, the weather was something else. First, all those twisters, and then just downpours of rain. A once-in-500-year event, we heard here from NBC News' Brian Williams, talking with Mike Saddell, Weather Channel meteorologist.
Nearly 6 inches of rain in Pensacola last night in 1 hour is almost a once-in-a-500-year event, and all that water here on the Fish River led to a record crest this morning.
Kristen, is this just news coverage, or do we have crazier weather? Fires again in L.A., water all over in the South. The question always comes up, are we into something new here? Or
It certainly feels that way, I think, to some extent, Tom, and a lot of people would make the argument that we are. And I think that's why you're seeing the administration weigh in and express their concern about this uptick in the weather. And you are seeing more news coverage. Now, of course, from the perspective of the news media, it's also interesting to look at some of these pictures and important to cover these communities that are hurting so much when they do experience extreme weather. I was out in Baltimore yesterday where a retaining wall actually collapsed. 8 cars fell
that.
About 75 feet onto a train track. Absolutely unbelievable. And residents there just really angry in part because they felt the retaining wall was weak to begin with, but also just stunned that something like this could happen. Really incredible to see the force of that.
I mean, it makes you think about all the infrastructure spending that has not been done. If we put that up against some kind of change in extreme weather, we could have a real pickle here. Yoki Driesen, I want to come to you on the economic front. We've got these new numbers out today saying U.S. payrolls gained 288,000 jobs in May. That's like, I don't know, 70, 80,000 more than expected. That's unusual and great, I guess. And also, unemployment rate down to 6.3%. We know many are still out of the workforce. Up against that, we had this report that China, the World Bank is saying, this year, by the end of this year, is on track to become the number one economy by sheer size in terms of purchasing power. And the United States would not hold that position for the first time since 1872. What do you make of that, Yoki?
You know, it's been an interesting week, certainly, in terms of economics. Two things are very interesting that jump out if you drill down into the numbers a little bit. First, on the U.S. side, the place where jobs are coming the quickest, interestingly, are in fields we thought were dead. There are manufacturing jobs and there are engineering jobs. There are things that we would have written off as being part of the distant past, and they've come back, especially by the fracking boom in some of the states that are now taking out natural gas. They're hiring skilled construction workers by the tens of thousands. And it's interesting. We never think of America being a manufacturing power again, and we're becoming one. On the China side, the numbers are a little bit tricky. If you look at overall size of the economy, we are still bigger. You know, purchasing power parity takes gross domestic product and basically adjusts for differences in exchange rates. It shouldn't, on one level, though, be surprising. And I think the importance of it has been massively overstated. China is at least 4 times the size of the U.S. in terms of population. Its economy has been booming for almost a decade. It's inevitable that a country of more than 1 billion people will have an economy bigger than a country of 300 million people. It's an interesting moment, but it's only one measure. By most other measures, will be bigger than China for a decade to come. So it's a moment, but it's not a landmark moment. A very, very quick point to one of the earlier callers on why the botched execution was botched. The major problem is all actually an international problem. Most of the drugs that are used for lethal executions are made in Europe. European companies will not sell them to the U.S. because under the law of most European countries and under the law of the European Union, you can't sell a product that will be used for killing someone. So we rely on Europe to give us the drugs used for these types of executions. Europe won't provide them. And that's why you have this disconnect, and that's why a reliance on drugs doesn't work.
We can't get drugs to kill the condemned. We can't get to the International Space Station, maybe, if Russia doesn't want to cooperate on that front. And now these numbers about China. I mean, I take your point that in absolute size, the U.S. May still be bigger for a decade, but to be bypassed even by a country with four times the population, it may make sense, but it's never happened since 1872. Here was some upset on that front from Nick Cavuto of Fox Business News.
I've long said the Chinese lie about a lot of stuff, but even figuring that half of what they're reporting ain't so, the trend that we in this country are growing at a fraction of China's pace is so. So whether it's this survey or some other, this reality, we are losing steam and fast.
Jack Beatty, latest numbers say we may be picking up some steam, though the first quarter was terrible. But big picture here, this is a new dynamic for the United States to look at. We displaced Great Britain. And ever since, number one, no matter what, no matter how big populations were elsewhere, there's throw weight in an economy, even if per capita, it's a very different picture in China.
Oh, and the symbolic import is just immense. You know, first China surpassed Germany as the world's biggest exporter, then Japan as the second biggest economy, now poised to overtake us on purchasing power, and perhaps even this year. There's another measure in which they're number one, and that, according to a just-published study from the University of Michigan, is income inequality. They have surpassed us.
Which is saying something these days.
It's really saying something when you get when you become more unequal than the United States. And the Chinese fear a rise in social unrest, that the poor will demand a better standard of living from the hated elite. And one Chinese economist I saw said that the U.S. safety net protects the U.S. against unrest. You know, we don't read that kind of candid comment over here about social backlash to inequality. He was suggesting that the American safety net not only protects the poor from desperation, it protects the rich from the poor.
Let's go to Mario in Boston. Mario, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. My comment was, you know, isn't China's position a result of what the U.S. economy has done to itself? I mean, it's my understanding that the majority of the companies that do manufacturing overseas, doing it in China and other countries that are developing, it affords them the ability to reap profits that they wouldn't be able to reap in America, in the current status that we are today. I mean, the wages they'd have to pay today, you know, what they're able to do in China, they're able to reap more benefits. So,
but what's the answer there, Mario? Should we bring our wages down to Chinese levels? That would mean cutting American income by about 10% of what it is.
I don't think we should bring our wages down, but I think, you know, people should stop complaining. You know, if shareholders and CEOs want to basically say we don't need to reap this much in profits and benefits, but we want to create more American jobs and help improve the economy. I mean, I think there's too much talk going around and too much greed coming from the top, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Yeah, Mario, I appreciate your call. I mean, part of the logic there is you raise the minimum wage and we're even less competitive, but we're supposed to be the country that gets it together, finds a new frontier, raises everybody up, minimum wage included. Thomas in Cleveland, Ohio. Thomas, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I was actually I was calling about the minimum wage increase.
Yeah.
And I've heard a lot about it over the last week or so, and I haven't heard a single person bring up the point of the middle class being starting to be phased out with that increase, because you if you raise the minimum wage to the 10-10. Those the jobs the skilled trained jobs such as welding and some of the more technical jobs that are making $15-16 an hour, those aren't increasing.
Wow. Thomas, I'm very sympathetic to that idea that you go out and you get all this training, let's say, to be a welder, and pretty soon you're making the same as someone working minimum wage, I don't know, at McDonald's. But then Yoki makes one ask, why don't we have an economy where the welder makes more than $15 an hour?
You know, it's a good question. What's interesting, though, about China is that their wages are actually rising very rapidly. So as China begins to develop this model middle class that's sort of reminiscent of what this country used to have, it is no longer the place to go to manufacture cheaply. You're now seeing companies move to Vietnam, to Bangladesh. So there's this chase downward invariably. So U.S. wages are too high, we go to China. China's wages become too high, they go to Vietnam. Vietnam becomes too high, they move to Bangladesh, and on and on and on. It's invariable that when a country does better, when manufacturing moves in, wages go higher. The difference always has been Can the U.S. manufacture enough things that require a skilled workforce, not just kind of blunt labor or blunt instruments, but things that really require skill? Can that outweigh this race to the bottom? And some of these numbers suggest that the answer may be yes, which in this welter, you know, Tom, as you mentioned, of bad news on almost every front, this is a small sliver of good news.
Well, a poke in the ribs from those Chinese numbers that the Chinese don't like to advertise, that number one slot. They tried to get the World Bank not even to talk about it, but a poke in the ribs to the U.S. to do better. Interesting this week, John Boehner under fire from conservatives in his party who did not like a comment that went pretty much unnoticed last week when he was sort of mocking his own fellow Republicans for not doing more on immigration, saying this, his party members said is just too hard. Here's that comment. It's very short from a town hall in Ohio. John Boehner.
But here's the attitude. Oh, don't make me do this. Oh, this is too hard.
Boy, his party's come down hard on him this week, Kristen Welker, taking a lot of heat from saying, hey, Mr. Speaker, this is your party, and we don't want to do this. Is the immigration dead with this backlash, immigration movement?
Well, I don't think it's dead, Tom, but I don't think there's a whole lot of optimism that you're going to see anything get done before the midterms. Look, the Speaker's office started to walk back those comments almost immediately. One of the officials in that office telling me, oh, you only tease the ones that you love. I'm really trying to downplay the comments he made. There's no doubt that the comments rankled his conference. But I think more broadly, there's just not a real appetite amongst Republicans to get something done, in part because they are heading into an election year, and a lot of their constituents, particularly in red states, don't think that this is a priority. And then there's also that major sticking point over a path to citizenship and border security. So I think that those are some of the large impediments. Now, what we could potentially see is a smaller piece of legislation getting passed. Republicans are saying that they want to do this, take a piecemeal approach to immigration reform. So could we potentially see one smaller bill pass this summer, potentially? That's a possibility. But I think it's very unlikely that you're going to see a comprehensive piece of legislation get passed. And don't forget, President Obama has directed his HHS secretary into looking into how deportations can be done more humanely. So you could see President Obama come out and announce an executive action on that point. And that would make it even tougher, I think, to get something done comprehensively on immigration.
Last week, at a closed-door meeting of the Trilateral Commission, Secretary of State John Kerry was reported saying, and apparently did, that Israel risked becoming an apartheid state if it didn't get a peace agreement. This week, all that effort of his, long effort of his, fell apart. Before it even fell apart, Republican Senator Ted Cruz went after Kerry for using that word. Here he is.
The fact that Secretary Kerry sees nothing wrong with making a statement comparing Israel's policy to the abhorrent apartheid policies of South Africa demonstrates a shocking lack of sensitivity to the incendiary and damaging nature of his rhetoric. It is my belief that Secretary Kerry has proven himself unsuitable for the position he holds.
Yoki, that looks in big, big trouble. It's kind of off the table this week.
It's incredible. I mean, you have John Kerry pouring an enormous amount of political capital and time into Israel and Palestine when you have Egypt in flames, Syria in flames, Jordan in flames, Turkey beginning to totter a little bit. You know, the apartheid comment, the word is toxic and cancerous, but it's a point he's made before. And frankly, it's a point that Israelis make, that if you have Palestinian growth rates be what they are, if you have Israeli growth rates be what they are, you will soon have more Palestinians living in the West Bank and Israel than you have Jews. And at that point, if they don't have equal rights, by definition, it's a two-class state, and that could be accurately described as apartheid. That said, for Kerry to walk into a room that, even if it was off the record, was stocked full of journalists and used the phrase apartheid is extraordinarily stupid. I mean, to be blunt, the idea that that wouldn't leak in some way, shape, or form in an age where everyone has a recording device, everyone in the room may mention it to someone else in passing. You know, Josh Rogan managed to get the recording of it or get the quotes, but the idea that that wouldn't leak is just extraordinary to me, the clumsiness of it all.
And then Benghazi back in the news this week, new emails out about a prep call for Susan Rice saying, talk about the videos of anger in the Middle East over videos. And here's an exchange, Jonathan Carl, ABC, with Jay Carney over that. Why did you hold back this information?
Why were you holding back this information? Why was this email not turned over to the Congress? Why was it not released when you released all the other emails? This is directly relevant. Why did you hold it back?
John, again.
Why did it take a court case for you to release this email?
John, I can say it again and again, and I know you can keep asking again and again. This document was not about Benghazi.
It was her prep for the Sunday show.
It wasn't her only prep, John.
Kristen Welker, here we are in your turf. Is this the smoking gun that the White House held back key information on how this depiction of Benghazi that turned out to be wrong came to be?
Well, the White House has spent multiple briefings just this week, Tom, pushing back against the notion that it's a smoking gun. But there's no problem, no doubting that the White House has a real optics problem here because they're getting bogged down in semantics. You know, in this case, they're saying that these newly released emails weren't solely focused on Benghazi, but rather the larger protests that were going on throughout the Middle East. And then the problem with that argument, of course, is that these emails in question were aimed at preparing Susan Rice for her appearances on those Sunday shows, which were undoubtedly going to focus on the attack against the U.S. consulate. So I think that there's a little bit of a disconnect there. And then, of course, I think their problems continue for a couple reasons, because they still haven't provided a clear picture of what actually happened in Benghazi that night, and then also because they haven't brought anyone to justice. So those are some of the lingering questions. I think the bottom line...
We're up against it. Oh, Kristen, I'm sorry, we're going to have to get the bottom line offline. We're up against it. Fires all over the world, and we look at Benghazi's Kristen Welker, Yoki Dries, and Jack Beattie. Thank you very much. This is On Point.